Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. I'm Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky. And of course, today we have a great topic for you. Now, you may have seen the news. It's been widely reported. The president of France, Emmanuel Macron, has suggested that France might be interested in expanding its nuclear arsenal to provide an umbrella over Europe. And, of course, some people are calling this the Euronuke. And it's something that has been discussed. And there was also some discussion that I think Curtis is more familiar with about the Germans a few months ago had a discussion about, does Germany need to look at nuclear weapons again? And as some of you may know, if you go back, 60 years, the Nordic countries looked at a nuclear program. At one point, Germany, West Germany, looked at a nuclear program. And then we've also seen Poland has said they'd like to host U.S. nuclear weapons. And Macron floated this idea he initially in 2020 invited other European NATO nations to observe training and exercises, French exercises that employed nuclear weapons. And then he also floated this idea of participation. And of course, Eastern European and Central European countries rejected the idea because they said, no, we want America to be the holder of the umbrella. And so they rejected it. But it's one of those things that is probably not going to go away. And this is in large part due to the invasion of Ukraine and Russia's consistent threat to use nuclear weapons. So let me go to you first, Curtis. Can you offer us more about why this topic has come up and why it's sort of a pertinent topic of debate and discussion in Europe?
Well, thank you, Adam. I always enjoy it when we start off the show and you throw it my way to get us going here with these heavy topics. I'll tell you what, there is a lot to love and a lot to hate about this whole Macron speech and I guess his thought process about what he thinks Europe ought to do. Let me just first say that, you know, what he's discussing here or I guess positing is that there should be a credible European defense led by 300 French nuclear weapons. And this is an interesting prospect when we think about France and its nuclear weapons. I tell my students all the time that if you ever hope to disarm the world of its nuclear weapons, the last nation after China and Russia will be France. And so we have to really understand what nuclear weapons, even though it's a fairly small arsenal at somewhere in, say, 300-ish kind of warheads, by depending who's counting. It's a fairly small arsenal, although some of these articles have said that it's larger than the United Kingdom's. But they've been very close-knit with their nukes, right? They won't share their nukes, and they have never shared their nukes with NATO. So it seems weird that they're willing to share their nukes or talking about sharing their nukes with the European Union. And so it's kind of interesting to hear a number of these issues. And if you actually go and listen to Macron's speech or read the transcript, there's some pretty interesting things in there. And what is motivating this is, I guess, the first question that one could and should ask. And that is this idea. At least in Macron's mind, he says in his statement that he's nervous, I guess, if you will, about whether or not the United States is going to continue to be a part of NATO, support the Europe writ large, I should say. And this can vary in different ways. You mentioned Germany. Germany recently said something about that they might need to have nuclear weapons, even though they completely eschew nuclear power, that they might have that desire nuclear weapons because they were afraid that if President Trump were reelected, that he would somehow pull the United States out of NATO, removing the American nuclear umbrella from the NATO nations. On others, there have been who may be nervous about the idea that there aren't enough nukes, or maybe that America's not energized enough. It's not assuring its allies enough with its modernization effort, numbers issues. We've seen this with Korea and other states. And, of course, Poland has been making a lot of noise, if you will, about wanting, as you mentioned, to host weapons. And a lot of these things have kind of led to the idea, well, what is it that they're thinking here with regards to America? And Macron says, hey, look, America has two priorities. America first, which he says is legitimate, and China. Europe is not a geopolitical priority in the coming years and decades, no matter how strong our alliance and how fortunate we are to have an administration that is very committed to the Ukrainian conflict. And so, yes, the days of Europe of buying its energy and fertilizers from Russia, outsourcing to China, and relying on the U.S. for security are over, according to Macron.
Here.
Quite a statement, right? Hey, U.S. isn't all in, even though we just passed, you know, $60 billion for Ukrainian defense, war, conflict, without any strategy of how this war is going to end. And also, Macron has recently made some verbal missteps where a few months ago he mentioned that maybe French troops or even NATO troops should go into Ukraine, to which the Russians and Putin had responded that, you know, they don't want to see any French troops in Ukraine. And I want to be very quiet, or I should say very clever about how I say that, because his response was quite nasty. I think also in gleaning from this speech, there's a lot of fear about a nuclear-armed Iran, which definitely has Europe within its range of its ballistic missile program, and that is a big problem. And if you go back to the early 2000s, Adam and Jim, when we think about all of the European missile defense effort that went on that really upset the Russians, it was about protecting Europe from Iran. And yeah. So... These strategies just continue to sort of orbit around these problems, and when they finally circle back around, we seem to continue to wrestle with these things. But clearly, there is an effort in Macron's mind that there should be some protection, some greater defense unity, if you will. And this isn't the first time Macron has spoken about this. He's given a similar speech back in 2017. I think that's where he may have talked about creating sort of this European army, this European response force sort of thing that I'm not sure has really come to a whole lot of fruition. But it's interesting that European countries are now talking about some sort of arrangement outside of NATO. That is quite interesting, and people will wonder, how's that play out? And I'll mention to you, there are a handful of states that are members of NATO, but are not members of the European Union. And Macron is talking EU; he's not talking NATO. So does this mean that states like Turkey, Albania, Norway, Iceland, the United Kingdom, Montenegro, and North Macedonia won't get to play in the French nuclear deterrent game? So curious how that would play itself out. I'll stop there.
So Jim, let me ask you from a technical perspective. France has the most advanced nuclear power program in Europe. It relies, I think, about two-thirds of its power come from nuclear energy. And there's always been a strong tie. I didn't realize this until I started doing interviews with folks from NNSA and DOE and some of the companies that work in the nuclear power industry. But weapons and power are really strongly tied together, and their success sort of ebbs and flows together. They're not these sort of completely separated entities. Can you talk a little bit about those relationships maybe? And then, you know, how would this impact how France could, you know, expand its arsenal, or why it might be interested in that you know, expansion?
Thanks, Adam. First, I want to address something that Curtis said, because, you know, you tossed this thing to him first. And I know why you do that, because I normally come off the rails. Because if you pass to me first, my first thought was about an umbrella. You know, I think of a French umbrella, sort of this parasol thing with the fringes on the side. Is that what we're talking about? Are we talking about like the English black umbrella that looks like a cane? Or maybe a giant golf umbrella that covers a whole lot of things. There's a whole lot of options here for umbrellas. So I was less focused on the nuclear weapon aspect and more on the umbrella aspect. But since we're going toward nuclear weapons here, let me answer your question. So first of all, I've mentioned this many times in this podcast and on our NIDS knowledge. And when you speak to me in person, you hear me say this oftentimes. When it comes to technology and science and technology, you can't just simply come up with technology out of nowhere. And you can't come up with expertise and personnel that have the knowledge and background out of nowhere. So what's interesting about France is they have, as you said, Adam, a very strong nuclear power program. Now, power and weapons, listen to my NIDS knowledge podcast, they are different. But the material aspects, the physics aspects, and the intelligence that you put into that, the science and technology, they are very similar. And so programs that have nuclear weapons tend to have nuclear power. And so they get connected in that way. Weapons and reactors are completely different. I just want to highlight that for the audience and for Curtis and Adam to make sure you guys understand that. But the other piece is that the science and technology people that you have available in France that have been solving this problem and working the technology to get the material, because the material is really the hard part. Get the material and get people that have the technology, the understanding, the skill set to be able to manufacture fuel in the way that they will need to do to build these weapons is in France. They're gone gangbusters because they've kept that technology, et cetera. That's what waned in the United States. Even when we sort of stepped away from the weapons and technology, we've also stepped away from the nuclear reactors and the building of the fuel and the radiology and the chemical separation processes and all these things that are essential if you're going to have a nuclear weapons program. Now, flipping that over to what Curtis said, I just want to echo that because I think this is the interesting part for me as a from a non-science and technology standpoint. And that was that you're seeing Europe and NATO, by and large, realizing the value of the deterrent aspect of nuclear weapons. And why is that? Because I feel a threat. And when you get to the threat point, you start saying there's a threat. We need to do something. We can't just sit here laissez-faire and let the threat control who we are and what we do.
And I think that's no fair using French words here.
oh, you noticed that. I thought I'd pull that one off.
Well, let me just add to that because it's very interesting on the technical side. I would also add that I think Macron really, this is where he kind of gets it right, I think. And then he embraces this idea that energy security equals national security, right? And if you think European security. And I think he realizes in this case, if you read through his transcript, that he really understands that French nuclear energy production is something that ought to be shared with most of Europe, all of Europe, as much as Europe can have, in order to wean itself from nations who might be hostile to you and who then become sole provider of fossil fuels and these sorts of things, which can then be leveraged and weaponized in that sense. And I think to Macron's credit, whether he uses the words or not, he's trying to rally the European countries to embrace more capabilities to develop their own energy and become less reliant on Russia, so to speak.
But that's, but Curtis, that feeds right into where I was heading, is that independence comes with that technology. You can't go to, you know, a country that doesn't have the science and technology background or the capability of developing the fuel. And of course, processing, by the way, France does reprocess unlike the United States. So they do a very efficient use of their nuclear materials. But that independence is what gives you strength. It's the dependence that your adversaries could use against you. That was the idea of the pipeline to Europe from Russia. Nord Stream? Strategically there to put a hammer over top of the Europeans. And Macron is saying, enough's enough. We can do it ourselves. Nuclear gives that. That's what I think is so cool about nuclear energy, but it follows through with nuclear weapons. It's the same thing. We are independent. We are capable of surviving and managing ourselves. The only thing you have to do is you have to make sure that it doesn't go rogue. But we are responsible countries as part of that, you know, league of people that have the weapons, responsible and feeding back. So I agree with that. I think that's the neat thing about this whole article.
So let me add to that. As nuclear weapons are about preventing nuclear coercion against you, nuclear power can be a great methodology to prevent energy coercion being used against you. These are all various forms of weapons that can threaten your way of life.
And remember, if you haven't seen Mad Max and Thunderdome, in the end, it's all about energy. There's nothing about money. It's all about controlling energy, right? And, you know, that realism is there.
Yeah, one thing that I haven't heard anybody mention is there's this, what do we want to call it? A boogeyman that's out there that apparently strikes fear into the hearts of America's allies because they fear that he's going to leave NATO and abandon NATO. And some of the Asian allies have a similar fear. And of course, I'm talking about the election of Donald Trump in November. And when it comes to why is there so much fear, there's a lot of Europeans who don't seem to separate rhetoric from reality. And so they see the rhetoric and they don't pay that close attention. So like whenever President Trump said, well, if you're not going to spend the 2% floor, then I'll let the Russians do what they want with you. He wasn't meaning that in a literal sense. And it's one of those things that it's difficult, and I don't think perhaps Trump does this all that well, is to understand that people will take his hyperbole literally when they want to, and his literal, words hyperbolically whenever they want to. And yeah, so it's led to this sort of questioning of whether America is still committed, which they are. America's committed.
Yeah, but even interpret it either way, I think there's value in Europe looking at its own self-preservation as a responsibility it has. Mm-hmm. And not only its self-preservation, but also its independence from other leaders and other countries, because that provides for prosperity and peace and security, which is in everybody's interest, regardless.
Well, I would disagree with you, Jim, because it's been very clear that the European social welfare state has been funded by the United States over the last 70 years. We've subsidized it. And so if you look at that ability to have that large overweening welfare state is only possible because we've essentially guaranteed European security. So they're going to have to give a lot up. And, I've talked to some Brits and others who've looked at demographics, and actually one of our fellows, Amit Gupta, wrote an excellent article that you can find on Global Security Review. If you go there and Google Amit Gupta, he looked at European population demographics. He looked at the budgets of these nations, defense spending. And for most of them, there's just no way they can dramatically ramp up their defense spending, nor can they expand their militaries because their populations, you know, have largely collapsed in terms of growth. They're essentially declining populations. And then now they've got, you know, these, you know, immigrant problems where you've got no-go enclaves in various arrondissements around Paris. And they, so they have their own problems. And even the French only spend 1.9% of their GDP on defense. So, you know, it's sort of a good thought on Macron's part. And we sort of all say, yeah, that's great. But then how do you actually do it?
Well, let me add to this just because I don't want to lose track of where we are. You know, Macron opens his speech with more or less here that Europe is mortal and it can die. And his speech here on this sort of strategic sufficiency really gets down to not only the defense, but the defense industrial capacity is not there. And he even talks about border security, and he's talking Europe's borders, and that how even though France's borders aren't on the borders of Europe, because of the way the system flows through the EU, people can move with relative freedom. That it affects everybody, right? Just like in America, every state's a border state, sort of thing. He goes on. He says essentially the dividends of peace have meant that Europeans have insufficiently produced and invested, which has also created a high level of dependence on non-European industry. We must produce faster. We must produce more. And we must produce more in Europe. Adam, Jim, I proffer that Macron is preaching a Make France Great Again speech, and he is all about Europe first. Yet we consistently hear a lot of issues about America first, whether or not another presidency of a Donald Trump would affect how that would affect Europe. And so forth. I'll remind everybody, and we've talked about this in past podcasts, that it was President Obama that really started getting after the allies about free riders and not paying their fair share, if you will. And if we look at today, many, many more states, not all of them, I think they're approaching half now of the NATO countries are actually meeting their 2% goal. And France isn't one of them. And yet they're asking to create so much more. I would ask France first to meet their NATO obligations and maybe be willing to share with their nukes with NATO, and then see if that is palatable enough to them that they should go and forward and share that with the rest of Europe. I'm just not sure there's enough proof in that pudding when we listen to Macron talk about a lot of great things, but I'm just not sure that his past performance is going to be indicative of a future result.
Yeah, so I appreciate that commentary there, Curtis. But so I guess we all look at this thing a slightly different way. So I look at this at least as a starting point. You wouldn't have heard this 10, 15 years ago from France, and you're hearing it now, which is good news. So I look at, you know, I'm looking across the screen. I don't know what our audience sees, but I see me and I see Curtis, I see Adam. So I look at me, I'm the glasses half full. Curtis is the glasses half empty. Adam is the glasses broken and shattered. I get that. Okay. But I mean, that's our personalities.
It's
coming
out
of us. Yeah. So, but in the end, you know, you got to take what you can get. And if at least France is talking about this, and I think Petrosky's view, and again, I'm not king for a day, but I think it's good that Europe would be able to provide its own security with nuclear weapons. I think we'd have more stability. Now, there's people that'll argue against that, but I think we'd be more stable. It's about time we look at that as a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. It's this idea. The only thing is I don't want the U.S. completely out of Europe, you know, in terms
of... Never said that.
I don't think anybody does.
The glass is not half shattered. You can have a little bit of both, Adam.
And even half empty says that the U.S. has got to stay in NATO, right? What does NATO exist for? You know, it was to, right, keep the Russians out, the Germans down, and the Americans in, or however you want to swap that around. And that is essentially, I don't think has changed or ever changed. But Macron makes good points here that their economy hasn't grown as fast as the American economy has. And I think he notes that there are a lot of challenges here. And I think we have to wonder, what is it that motivates Macron to do this? Well, he's having some political challenges at home. From what I've been reading here, the far right and the far left of his government have really not been very supportive of what he's proffered here with this idea of a French-led nuclear defense. And that's very interesting in that regard. And from what I can tell, they have elections coming up.
They've got a...
That's right. So there's elections coming up. So Macron is trying to save his political world. What this really does, gentlemen, is it highlights the political value of nuclear weapons yet again, right? And so in NATO particular right now, or in Europe particular, I should say, they're now having this conversation yet again in a different way. And it is playing politics, so to speak, both inside and outside the France. So I proffer here that there are four things that are motivating Macron to do this. And I think the first one is if this were to happen, this would certainly assert and solidify French leadership within Europe, right? And I think there's a goal for France. They want to be the big kahuna of Europe, so to speak, and maybe not allow Germany or England, UK to have that. I think if they proffer this argument, they get to set the terms and parameters for how this defense mechanism works, right? When you invent the idea, you get to start setting and shaping the rules, so to speak. The third one, I think, here is it's an opportunity to sell French weapon systems, French capabilities. And so there's some money to be made here as you become a major supplier within Europe. And then the fourth one here is I think it looks to raise France on the prestige of France on the international stage, right? Raise the global WASTA, if you will, of French politics. Again, it's a former empire that has, is smaller than what it once was. And I think there is some definite efforts to do those things. So I think this is what the major motivator is, aside from maybe the desire for a more free and independent Europe.
Yeah, and Curtis, you brought up a really nice point, and I'll point back to the reactor side. I mean, Areva, which is the French reactor program, they are gangbusters and world suppliers of reactors because they do this and they do this well. They have a great safety record. They have the science and technology, as I said before. They have the experiences. One time there was an interest in building something called the Global Energy Partnership. I'm missing a letter coming off the top of my head. But essentially it was to build a users group of people that would process uranium and provide it to countries to be able to build nuclear reactors. And GNEP, it was a Global Nuclear Energy Partnership. And interestingly, that France wanted to lead it because they had the background. Of course, the other nations said, no, we want to lead it because, of course, there was an opportunity for investment and finances, et cetera. But that is the place where France, I think, has taken the lead in Europe, which I think is good in this area. What a great concept. Economics always drives a lot of things.
Absolutely. Follow the money.
Well, and if you look at France, we do want to look at France economically, the French economy will never match the German economy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's significantly smaller. I don't see the sort of cultural and social changes that would be required for a sort of free market, if you want to, like a European liberalism, pro-capitalist, limited regulation, that would take that kind of dramatic change in France to then start experiencing dramatic growth in the French economy, because France is essentially, their economy's in decay, but they're really good at nuclear power. That's something they do really well. And so if Germany's going to be the dominant economic power, And they clearly have no interest or ability, it seems, to be the dominant military power, then maybe that's something, you know, that France can do. And it's an area where France can be, a you know, the leading European nation in, you know, in that term. But the East Europeans, or what we call New Europe, still want, you know, the United States to play that leading role. And, you know, the U.S. is speeding up, the deployment of B-61 Mod 12s to Europe. And, you know, there's quite a bit of investment that's going on at the DCA bases. And so there's a lot underway. Both, you know, the British are going to expand their arsenal. The French are doing the same. We're investing. And so that theater nuclear capability, it seems, is, you know, it's growing and expanding. And regardless of who wins the election, I don't see the Americans. We may see an expansion before long of new capabilities and additional numbers. I don't think that's out of the realm. Regardless of whether it's, you know, Biden or Trump, that may be coming.
I'm not sure I agree with you there, Adam. I think right now, of all the countries, it appears only the United States is not expanding or seeking to expand its numbers in the near future. When we just talk about the aggregate of nuclear numbers, which is ironic when we have the nuclear umbrella extended deterrence obligation. And we seem to not understand or sympathize with nations who want to believe that we will provide our nuclear umbrella, but don't add to the numbers to sort of account for their issues. And so, and then when they want to, as we like to call nuclear participate, proliferation has such a negative connotation. When you're a nation that is responsible, first world, and wants to participate and project your own national security, something that is a very real and legitimate goal, the United States actually tends to get in the way and work very hard to prevent you from doing that. And the case in point is Poland right now, South Korea. And so if I'm a European nation, what am I to think? You know, are these guys really on my side? But I think the end, you know, no one seems to be demanding America to bring more troops into Europe or to reopen up, you know, the old, you know, German air bases and so forth. So, you know, where are we in all of this? But, and if you're really nervous, and I know we're getting ready to wrap up here, I wanted to share just one more statement that I thought was a pretty bold statement of Macron that I think a lot of NATO, including the United States, could really take a lesson to. And he says, quote, "Because we are facing a power that no longer has any inhibitions, that has attacked a European country and is no longer involved in a special operation and no longer wants to tell us what its limits are, why should we have to say every day what our strategic limits are?" And so he's purposely trying to bring back strategic ambiguity from a French perspective. And I think his point here now is that the game has changed. And we have to change with it. And I don't think the United States has figured that out yet, at least the current administration. But Europe is starting to figure this out. And Macron may be the thought leader in this space. And so, I mean, with that, I guess I would applaud him.
All right, Jim, we are out of time, but I wanted to give you the last word.
Well, my last word is we're out of time. Because our audience is probably at the door and ready to get out of their cars and head off, because that's what we do with our podcasts. We give somebody something to listen to while they're driving to work. But I want to also mention that NIDS is doing a lot with Global Security Review. We do have HUSI events where we have seminars that we're putting out on a biweekly basis. And more of this kind of information gets transferred around, as well as our podcasting network and, of course, our NIDS Academy with our courses. So I'll throw the advertisement on the end of this podcast for everyone. Go to thinkdeterrence.com and check us out and let us know what you think. So I'm going to pass it back to Adam because we're doing a lot aside from podcasting. Which is great.
All right. Go ahead, Adam. Well, thanks, Curtis. Thanks, Jim. And thanks to you, the listeners.
Thanks
for joining us. And of course, send us your comments, your questions, your suggestions, because as our, you know, we had an episode here a few weeks ago where one of our listeners joined us on the show and we, you know, we talked about the Annie Jacobson book. That was a great opportunity, great show. So, you know, interact. We're here to entertain, inform, and inspire. And of course, I always want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.